Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Even Tommy Robinson has had enough of the English Defence League. The 30-year-old hairdresser from Luton has stepped down as leader of the EDL, claiming that the presence of extremists within the organisation was compromising his message. So is this the death knell of the far right in Britain, or simply a hiccup? Also, no sex please, we're British. What Channel 4's strangely puritanical orgy, Sex Box, tells us about our island hang-ups. I'm joined in the studio by left-wing blogger Sunny Handal, The Telegraph's Dan Hodges, and by the deputy editor of The Telegraph's Wonder Women, Louisa Peacock. Tommy Robinson has stepped down as head of the EDL to work with the Quilliam Foundation, saying that he has seen the light and will no longer court with far-right extremists. Without its most high-profile member, the EDL is tipped to disappear into obscurity. Tommy might have been a thug, but he was an articulate thug, and he leaves behind him an organisation staffed by people who probably can't even spell EDL. So another far-right group bites the dust. In 2009, the BNP's membership stood at more than 12,000, but the last available figures showed it to be down to 4,872, with fewer than 2,000 of those actually engaged with the party. The party may have two MEPs, but its glory days are clearly far behind it. Like the EDL, it seems to have collapsed under the weight of bad publicity, internal bickering, and plain old-fashioned incompetence. So have we finally killed off the far right in this country, or is this just the latest in a long cycle of success and failure and success and failure that will, inevitably, repeat itself in a few years' time? Dan Hodges, what do you think is the state of play for Britain's fascists?
Well, it's quite clear that the far right in Britain have effectively been smashed. I mean, obviously we've seen the Tommy Robinson's departure from the EDL. The EDL will now collapse as a political entity. Obviously we've seen the decline, the implosion of the BNP and the BNP support. At the European elections, the BNP will lose both of their European seats, and at that point the BNP will collapse. It's quite clear there will be a sort of a marginal extremist threat that will always be prevalent in Britain, and that has to be guarded against. But the days where we thought that there was a possibility of an extremist far-right breakthrough, or the far-right breaking through into the political mainstream in this country, are now dead, and social change, demographic change, will mean that they're basically dead for good now.
Sunny, do you agree with that very optimistic analysis?
No, I don't at all. I think that these things are very much about cycles. And I also think that there is a constituency within this country which is shrinking, no doubt, but it's still there, which is always going to be very hostile towards people who are non-whites, and very hostile towards immigration, very hostile towards Muslims. And I think it's just actually a matter of some personality being able to unite them, being able to give them a voice and give them some energy and enthusiasm. And Tommy did that, you know, well, because he used the spectre of the Al-Muhajirun. This was the Muslim extremist group which was, did that demonstration against soldiers coming back from Afghanistan. And he used them effectively to build up this massive countrywide force, which was mostly populated by football firms. And so he gave them a sort of an energy to coalesce around. And I don't think that the energy is gone for the time being, but that doesn't mean that those people have gone away. And the EDL will inevitably splinter and collapse. But that doesn't mean that, you know, no one else can come back in a few years' time and then use some event or some way to sort of bring this energy back and get people organised again.
Is there a disagreement between the two of you over the size of the constituency for fascism in this country?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'll see what Sunny thinks. I mean, certainly there is just simply not enough support for an extremist party in this country for it to secure the necessary political mass, critical mass, amongst the electorate to break through. I mean, to an extent, Sunny's right. Obviously, the corpse of, you know, the British far right will on occasion twitch. But what you have to understand is this was their moment. I mean, this was the point at which the far right should have made the breakthrough on their terms. We had a situation where we had the implosion and collapse of Labour's traditional working class base.
I wouldn't go that far.
Let's not have a Labour argument about this, Sonny. I mean, you had a significant decline, if you like, in Labour's working class base and Labour's support.
It is a very important factor, that sense of Labour having abandoned.
But also, you also had a situation where some of the more extreme politics, as characterised by Thatcherism, was being pushed to one side by David Cameron. So, in a political sense, there was an opportunity there. You had obviously the recession, the collapse of the economy with all the impact, all the reasons we had. We had immigration rising to the top
right.
of the list of politically salient issues. All of those things together created a perfect storm that the far right should have exploited. And when they failed to do it in 2010, that was the key moment. When the BNP failed to win a seat in 2010, that was the moment at which the tide turned.
Sunny.
Well, remember this. In 1979, everyone thought that the National Front was going to romp home, and Margaret Thatcher managed to defuse that bomb actually by adopting some of the language, and she was heavily criticised for it, and some people said actually it was good that she managed to take the wind out of the National Front's sails. But that doesn't mean that
This is when she said in an interview that people were worried about being swamped by immigrants.
Exactly. And the word swamped was controversial for good reasons at the time. So all I'm saying is we have been here before, firstly. So let's not just assume that, this was the big moment and it's gone now and, they're going to die, because actually these moments come and go. The second point is, in 2010, yes, that the Labour's vote collapsed, but actually what we're seeing is a broader general trend where both parties are losing support. And that's why even the Conservatives didn't manage to get a full a majority. And so actually what's happening is that people are becoming generally disconnected from national politics for various reasons. And some of those people are going to extreme parties. The BNP offer them some choice. UKIP, obviously, we've seen their rise, and they offer some of that sort of that choice too. And I think that's going to be the big factor in the next election. But so it's not a matter of, it's too easy to just say, well, the Labour Party is losing its traditional working class vote, and therefore those people are going over to, a lot of the support for, certainly EDL anyway, but the BNP and other people isn't all just working class.
No.
And so it's too easy to just say, oh, these working class people. Remember a few weeks ago, I exposed the whole traditional Britain thing, where Jacob Rees-Mogg was there.
Right.
Well,
of course, I mean, that's 12 people in a room. That's 12 posh people in a room. I don't think that has the same kind of cultural or impact. But one thing that's similar between the 70s and that period in the noughties is the decline of a viable, legitimate right-wing party. The Tories moved to the centre in the 70s. They were headed by Ted Heath. They'd embraced Europe. In the noughties, they moved towards David Cameron. Is that part of what creates the breeding ground for the far right and for its success? And then when the Tory party starts to talk about immigration again, it goes away.
It does, but I mean, I think the reality is that in the 1970s, Britain was attempting to come to terms, which was with a process of quite significant demographic and social change. We had a the first, well, not the first in the history of the land, but certainly the first significant post-war mass migration. And obviously there were issues at that were always at some point going to come to the surface. But the point is, in both the 70s and now, the reality is the threat has been faced and it has been successfully confronted. And there's a reason for that, which is quite clearly that whatever the sort of mini demagogues who run these organisations, the Griffins, the Robinsons, may say, the British people just simply are not an extremist people. We are by instinct a moderate people. And it is just impossible for these extremist parties of the right and of the left, actually. I mean, there, we've seen a decline in support for extreme parties on the left. It's just not possible for them, particularly given our electoral system, for them to get the foothold that they need and the foothold that we've seen possibly extremist and fascist parties get in mainland Europe.
Well, I mean, again, I don't disagree. And I'll say why. Actually, I think it's much more to do with personalities than anything else. So Nigel Farage has given UKIP a boost in a way that, you know, UKIP hadn't managed for years. And also remember, Netherlands, everyone thought of as a very moderate sort of a centrist country. And then the whole Geert Wilders phenomenon came along and kind of really upset the whole political sort of system. So actually, it's less to do with, I mean, I think we like to see ourselves as a moderate country. And actually, generally, compared to the rest of Europe, we are definitely. And this country is far more tolerant than most of Europe. But I would say that let's not get too complacent. What we're seeing actually is the rise of the respectable far right. And what's going to happen now is it's not that, by the way, I don't think Tommy Robinson is joining the Quilliam Foundation. What is actually going to happen is he's going to, in my view, join the sort of the respectable far right circuit, which Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer, two hate bloggers from the right, far right in the United States, they've been sort of pioneering, where you make money by writing or talking up the threat of Muslims, and you sort of do it in a non-street way, not in a way that allows you to, you know, for people to throw accusations of racism, of anti-Semitism at you. So I think what's going to happen is he's going to join that circuit. He's going to make money. He's going to be in the media, and he's going to try and keep his name up there. And he said quite clearly in his press conference a couple of days ago that he wants to lead a revolution against Islamism. I mean,
right.
Tommy Robinson is the last guy who's capable of doing that. So, but he's going to still try it. And there's going to be lots of people out there who are going to be willing to pay to listen to him to do that. And he's going to exploit that.
Okay. It seems to me that another difference between the two of you is, Dan, you see fascism as something that happens under certain historical circumstances. That, as you say, was a reaction to mass immigration in the 60s. And then recently it was a reaction to the political situation. Whereas I sense, Sonny, you're saying that actually it's something that's always there. And Britain isn't nearly as comfortably moderate as we sometimes like to imagine it is.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that the vast majority of Britons are intolerant and just going to jump in bed with fascists if the opportunity arises. That's not the case at all. But I do think that there is a significant percentage of the population. It's not that big, and actually it's declining. But I think they just need direction. And
right.
So if someone is able to give them direction, that's going to happen on the streets. On the other hand, I think if someone charismatic, someone like Nigel Farage, who's trying to get away from the sort of the extreme wing of his party, but if someone was to be able to give voice to those issues in a way that was charismatic, in a way that came off as very respectable, and I think that actually a lot of people, even the EDL, will coalesce around that agenda, and it's just a matter of someone charismatic enough to pull that off. And that's the danger here. Actually, because the EDL is now effectively collapsed, those people are now going to look for a new leader.
Right.
And my worry is that a new leader will come along and say, actually, we don't need to be on the streets, but we do need to be some sort of a campaigning thing, not necessarily political in the way that the UKIP is trying to be, but still be able to get votes, be able to shake up the political system like Geert Wilders did. Still push his agenda.
Dan.
I mean, one area where I do agree with Sonny. I mean, there is no room for complacency. And one of the things that we have missed out from the discussion, I mean, one of the reasons why the extremists have been smashed in the way that they have is actually they have come up against quite a sophisticated, certainly in relative terms compared to the sort of operations in the past, quite a sophisticated anti-fascist campaign. I mean, I used to work for Hope Not Hate, which was one of those groups, and the nature of our campaigning activity shifted quite dramatically when we saw the threat posed by the BNP. I mean, traditionally, anti-fascist campaigning was very much out on the streets. It was run through, you would set up a pop concert or you'd have a lecture. And the nature of the campaign shifted. There was a much more gathering of intelligence, identifying who the people were, what their policies were, what their agendas were, and mobilising on the ground in a very targeted way to confront them at the ballot box. And that's been very effective. And the reality is, despite what Sonny is obviously right about there being a threat, the reality is, so long as we don't take our eye off the ball, so long as moderates are prepared to stand up and confront fascism, where we find it, then the reality is the fascists simply aren't strong enough to defeat us because there are more of us and we are stronger than they are.
Okay, okay. Final question, because you're both men of the Labour Party to varying degrees.
Dan had left, hasn't he?
And so you've only just joined. You're a newbie.
A man of the broad left.
And I quit years ago. But my final question is this. Part of the rise of the BNP and the EDL is down to that sense that Labour has lost touch with its working class roots. What can Ed Miliband do? What can the contemporary Labour Party do to fill in that space and to bring those people back into mainstream politics?
I think we need a lot more working class voices, and the Labour Party is still reeling from the defeat of 1992. And I think what's happened is since then is that they're too afraid of making Labour a broad church, whereby people of the left are given free rein, are allowed to go out there and campaign very strongly, and the leadership does not want to look too close to them, look that they're too close to them, because they're worried about what the media is going to say. And I think that if the Labour Party did become a much more broader church, then you would have lots of people, working class people, being able to identify with some of their MPs and say, actually, I like this person. I might not like everyone within the Labour Party, but I do like a few people there. I'm going to join that party, and they're able to speak to me in my language. And I think the problem is the Labour Party itself has become too narrow and dominated by Oxbridge types, you know, people, swonks, spads, those kind of people. And I think that's dangerous. And once that church becomes broader and people are able to speak to lots of people, then it'll become much more popular.
Okay, okay, Dan.
I think two things. I think certainly there is absolutely no doubt, whatever you think about his strategy, Ed Miliband is taking the party back towards its, if you like, its left-wing roots, and that will have an impact and a significant element of that working-class support that was lost, I think you will see starting to return. The danger for the broader debate, though, is that we cannot take the debate so far to the left that people who do have legitimate concerns about the impact of immigration, who do have legitimate concerns about what they see as sort of the cultural change that is taking place in society, in their society, that they are not brushed out from the debate. We have to have an argument, and we have to have a debate about these issues. We can't simply brush them aside.
Dan Hodges and Sunny Hundal, thank you both very much. Two people have sex in a box live on TV. Then they talk about how it made them feel. Embarrassed would be the obvious answer, and when this bedroom farce was broadcast on Channel 4, everyone was both stunned and slightly disappointed. Sex Box, hosted by Mariella Frostrup, was a weird example of obscene TV without any actual obscenity. We were promised sex, but never got to see any, because it was done inside a box. It's a classic example of the British being simultaneously obsessed by sex, but also being oddly puritanical about it. So what is the British attitude towards sex, and is it strictly healthy? Louisa, what was your reaction to Sex Box?
Well, first of all, it was probably one of the most boring television programmes I've seen in quite a long time. You know, typical of Channel 4 in a way. They try and do something taboo. They try and break the mould. Everybody tunes in. In fact, I read yesterday 1 million viewers tuned in. So it's obviously appetite for this stuff. And yet, there I was watching it. And before long, I'm sort of making a cup of tea, finding excuses not to watch it. You know?
But that was because it was boring rather than...
It was boring, yeah.
Too hot to handle.
Well, precisely. I mean, as you say, that it was sex on TV without sex on TV. So it was sex within a box. A couple of couples walked into the box, had sex, did their thing. None of the juicy stuff was mentioned. They came out, and typically British were very reluctant to talk about what they just... experienced. And there was this rather bizarre panel of sexperts, they call them experts, who were trying to get out of these people what they'd done, essentially, but all it ended up was a load of euphemisms and giggling, and it was just a load of nonsense.
But people don't really in their private lives want to talk about sex. I mean, you know, it's very much a case of lights off and socks on, and then straight for the tea made. I mean, it's not something people feel naturally comfortable about talking about in British society anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, no sex please, we're British is still very much the mantra, I'm afraid, in this country. In fact, at The Telegraph, we've introduced a new agony aunt over the last year on the Telegraph Wonder Woman section. And she answers, she's external, she is one of these sexperts, and she answers queries from members of the public about sex, men and women.
Right.
And you'd be really surprised at some of the questions we get, which are really simple things. What is good sex? What is acceptable sex? What happens if my partner says this? What happens when I can't communicate to him afterwards? What happens when he turns the lights off and goes to bed? And, you know,
right.
This is a really common problem that people right. in Britain are grappling with every day. And yet, you know, it's essential for TV to grapple with it too and try and get the issues out there. But when it does, it just fails miserably.
How old do you think some of those people are writing in? Because there's sort of questions I can imagine a 16 or 17-year-old worrying about.
None. Well, it's a real range. We tend to get sort of women and men in their early 20s,
right.
I would say is probably the average. But you get a lot of middle-aged men as well and sort of older men. It tends to be, when they're older, it tends to be the man, surprisingly, that is...
Right, okay.
Yeah, so it's been a real eye-opener for us because we thought we might... We do occasionally, of course, get some dodgy questions and some, you know, ridiculous questions, you know, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really is just the simple stuff that us Brits just can't seem to deal with.
Well, if I wrote in, I think I'd probably ask, what is sex? At 31, well, it's still a mystery to me.
Actually, that's a really good point because I don't want to get too juicy in the detail here,
right.
but it came up on the show too, Sexbox, that it's not always about penetrative sex.
Right.
There's all sorts of other things, foreplay, oral sex.
Reading a good book, listening to Radio 4.
Whether you're on your own, whether you're in a threesome, all these, it's still taboo now, us talking about it, it's still embarrassing for us to talk about because
yeah.
we don't like to talk about it, but nobody really knows what sex is, but
it's
know.
Very different on the continent, of course, where it actually seems that their culture is saturated by sex. Does that mean they're more liberal and liberated than us?
Oh, that's a tricky question. I know, especially in the Scandinavian countries, for example, which is probably where you're getting at, sex in school, at least, is very much less of a taboo subject.
Right.
It's talked about. They have lessons that are so frank, and we would all balk at them over here. But,
yeah.
You know, the kids over there are taught to talk about this stuff and relate to this stuff and interpret it from such a young age, way before they even start having sex.
Yeah.
But when they do start to have sex, it's not such a big issue, and therefore, you know, I mean, I know people in my family, friends of the family, etc., who live in these countries, and they've split. I mean, this is a bit of a long story, but they split up with their partners and have divorced and etc. purely because he cheated on them because of the sexual relationship,
right?
And it's nothing to do with love or anything like that, but it's the sex that sort of got in the way, and you know, they seem to be sort of much more normal talking about that.
Okay,
so it's
okay.
a very interesting sort of dynamic between what they think is normal and what we do.
But on the other hand, I think in some ways they're more culturally conservative than us. I mean, the British like to think of themselves as being liberated in a sort of political sense of having gay rights and things like that, whereas, you know, Italian society is far more Catholic and conservative, even if it's television at some times. Just seems to be like a pornographic game show.
Well, just look at how Italy treats its women as well.
Right, exactly, yeah.
You know, it's completely different over here. So yes, you're right. Why is it that something that's so taboo over here, which is sex, is still so, it's fine over there, but yet the sort of more fundamental human rights, as it were, are still far behind where we are. It is a very strange, there's no sort of quick answer to that.
Is there actually a link between being both prurient and puritanical, between being both sort of anxious about sex but also being obsessed with it?
Oh, I think so, definitely. I think the fact that we can't talk about sex, it makes it taboo, and therefore you want to know more about it and you want to find out more about it, and it becomes this incredibly exciting topic that no one's talking about. If we were more open about it and could talk about what is sex, what is good sex, etc., you know, kids would lose interest. It's,
right.
it's the same with drugs.
Right.
You know, the more you talk about drugs and build up drugs as this huge, massive thing that, you know, you can't do and you shouldn't do, the more we, and again, the European countries are a lot better at sort of explaining what drugs are to the young people, and they have less problems with drugs, you know.
Right, okay.
So there must be a link between...
But we're not going to talk about it in this country. It's rude. It's dirty. We're just not going to do it. It's just be too awkward.
I think there are some really good forums online, like I say, for this kind of thing. But yeah, perhaps TV at the moment isn't the right or ready for this kind of aspect yet.
Louisa, thank you very, very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.